A year and a half later, Julia died abruptly in their New York home. McKim wore their wedding ring on his left pinky, and in times of stress or sorrow, absent-mindedly touched its twin interlocking hearts. He did not remarry. The Eastern architects wore dark suits and crisp white collars. All had mustaches, some dark, some gray. Post was huge, the largest man in the room. Hunt was fierce, a frown in a suit, with a client list that included most of America's richest families. Every other mansion in Newport, Rhode Island, and along Fifth Avenue in New York seemed to have been designed by him. But he also had built the base for the Statue of Liberty, and was a founder of the American Institute of Architects. All the men had one or more elements of shared background. Hunt, McKim, and Peabody each had studied at L'École des Beaux-Arts in Paris. Van Brunt and Post had studied under Hunt. Van Brunt had been Peabody's mentor. For Burnham, with his failed attempts at getting into Harvard and Yale and his lack of formal architectural training, sitting down to dinner with these men was like being a stranger at someone else's Thanksgiving. The men were cordial. Burnham described his vision of a fair larger and grander than the Paris Exposition. He played up the fact of Olmsted's participation. Both Olmsted and Hunt were hard at work on George Washington Vanderbilt's manor, Biltmore, near Asheville, North Carolina, and together had built the Vanderbilt family's mausoleum. But Hunt was skeptical and not shy about expressing his doubts. Why should he and the others interrupt their already full schedules to build temporary structures in a far-off city where they would have little control over the final product? Their skepticism shook Burnham. He was accustomed to the headlong civic energy of Chicago. He wished Olmsted and Root were beside him. Olmsted to counter Hunt, Root because of his wit, and because the other architects all knew him from his role as secretary of the American Institute of Architects. Ordinarily, it was in situations like this that Burnham could be most effective. To himself, and indeed to most of the world in general, he was always right, wrote Harriet Monroe, and by knowing this so securely, he built up the sheer power of personality which accomplished big things. But this night, he felt ill at ease, a choir boy among cardinals. He argued that Chicago's fair, unlike any other before it, would be primarily a monument to architecture. It would awaken the nation to the power of architecture to conjure beauty from stone and steel. Olmsted's plans alone would make the exposition unique, with lagoons, canals, and great lawns all set against the cobalt blue steppe of Lake Michigan. In exhibit space, he told them, the fair would be at least one-third larger than what the French had allotted in Paris. This was no mere dream, he said. Chicago had the resolve to make this exposition a reality, the same resolve that had made the city the second largest in America. And, he added, it had the money. The architect's questions became slightly less challenging, more practical. What kind of structures did he envision, and in what style? The issue of the Eiffel Tower arose. What could Chicago do to equal that? On this score, Burnham had no plan other than somehow to surpass Eiffel. Secretly, he was disappointed that the engineers of America had not yet stepped forward with some novel but feasible scheme to eclipse Eiffel's achievement. The architects worried that anyone who joined the fair would find himself in the grip of innumerable committees. Burnham guaranteed complete artistic independence. They wanted to know in detail how Olmsted felt about the sites selected for the fair, in particular about a central feature called the Wooded Island. Their insistence prompted Burnham to telegraph Olmsted immediately and urge him once again to come. Again, Olmsted demurred. One question came up repeatedly throughout the evening. Was there enough time? Burnham assured them that ample time remained, but that he had no illusions. The work had to start at once. He believed he had won them. As the evening ended, he asked, "Would they join?" There was a pause. Burnham left New York the next morning on the North Shore Limited. Throughout the day, his train pushed through a landscape scoured by snow as a blizzard whitened the nation in a swath from the Atlantic to Minnesota. The storm destroyed buildings, broke trees, and killed a man in Beaverton, Ohio, but did not stop the Limited. While aboard the train, Burnham wrote a letter to Olmsted that contained a less-than-candid description of the meeting with the architects. They all approved the proposition to have them take hold of the artistic part of the main buildings. The general layout seemed to meet the hearty approval, first of Mr. Hunt, then of the others, but they were desirous of knowing your views of the landscape on and about the island. Therefore, I telegraphed you urgently to come. They were very much disappointed, as was I, when it was found impossible to get you. The gentlemen are all to be here on the 10th of next month, and at that time they urgently request, as do I, that you will be here personally. I find that Mr. Hunt especially lays large stress upon your opinions in the entire matter. In fact, the evening had ended rather differently. At the Players' Club, sips of cognac and exhalations of smoke had filled that last difficult pause. The dream was an appealing one, the architects agreed, and no one doubted Chicago's sincerity in imagining this fantasy precinct of lagoons and palaces, but the reality was something else entirely. The only real certainty was the disruption caused by long-distance travel and the myriad other difficulties inherent in building a complex structure far from home. Peabody did commit to the fair, but Hunt and the others did not. They said, as Burnham later revealed, they would think it over. They did, however, agree to come to the January 10th meeting in Chicago to confer again and examine the chosen ground. None of the architects had been to Jackson Park. In its raw state, Burnham knew it was not a setting likely to win anyone's heart. This time Olmsted had to be present. In the meantime, Root, too, would have to become involved in the courtship. The architects respected him, but were leery of his powers as supervising architect. It was critical that he go to New York. Outside, the sky was blank, the light pewter. Despite Pullman's vestibules, ice as fine as dust settled between coaches and filled Burnham's train with the tang of deep winter. Wind-felled trees appeared beside the railbed. Daniel Burnham arrived in Chicago to find the city's architects and members of the exposition board outraged that he had gone outside the city, to New York of all godforsaken places, to court architects for the fair, that he had snubbed the likes of Adler, Sullivan, and Jenny. Sullivan saw it as a sign that Burnham did not truly believe Chicago had the talent to carry the fair by itself. Burnham had believed that he might best serve his country by placing all of the work exclusively with Eastern architects, Sullivan wrote. Solely, he averred, on account of their surpassing culture. The chairman of the Grounds and Buildings Committee was Edward T. Jeffrey. With exquisite delicacy and tact, Sullivan said, Jeffrey, at a meeting of the committee, persuaded Daniel come to judgment to add the Western men to the list of his nominations. Hastily, Root and Burnham conferred and chose five Chicago firms to join the effort, among them Adler and Sullivan. Burnham visited each the next day. Four of the five put aside their hurt feelings and accepted immediately. Only Adler and Sullivan resisted. Adler was sulking. "I think he, Adler, had hoped to be in the position I was in," Burnham said. He was rather disgruntled and did not know. Now it was Root's turn to go to New York. He had to go anyway to attend a meeting of the directors of the American Institute of Architects, and planned afterward to take a train to Atlanta to inspect one of the firm's buildings. Root was in his office at the Rookery on the afternoon of New Year's Day, 1891, shortly before his departure, when an employee stopped by to see him. He said he was tired, the man recalled, and felt inclined to resign the secretaryship of the Institute. This was alarming, as he had never been heard to complain of too much work, and while it only indicated extreme physical exhaustion, and before he went home he became cheerful and hopeful again, it has its significance in the light of subsequent events. In New York, Root assured the architects again and again that he would do nothing to interfere with their designs. Despite his charm, the Chicago Inter-Ocean once called him another Chauncey M. Depew in postprandial wit and humor. He failed to arouse their enthusiasm and left New York for Atlanta, feeling the same degree of disappointment Burnham had felt 2 weeks earlier. His journey south did little to cheer him up. Harriet Monroe saw him upon his return to Chicago. He was depressed, she said, by the attitude of the Eastern men, whom he found singularly apathetic, utterly incredulous that any association of Western businessmen would give art a free hand in the manner he set forth. The dream was too extravagant ever to be realized, and they were extremely reluctant to undertake its realization against the hampering and tampering, the interferences petty and great, which they felt were certain to ensue. Root was tired and discouraged. He told Monroe he just could not get the men interested. He felt that this was the greatest opportunity ever offered to his profession in this country, and he could not make them appreciate it, she said. The architects did plan to come to Chicago for the January meeting, he told her, but reluctantly. Their hearts were not in it. On January 5, 1891, the Committee on Grounds and Buildings authorized Burnham to offer formal commissions to all 10 architects and pay each $10,000, equivalent today to about $300,000. It was a rich fee, considering that all Burnham wanted them to do was provide working drawings and make a few visits to Chicago. Burnham and Root would see to the construction of the buildings and manage the niggling details that typically haunted an architect's life. There would be no artistic interference. The Eastern men gave their tentative acceptance, but their concerns had not diminished. And they still had not seen Jackson Park. A hotel for the fair. Holmes's new idea was to turn his building into a hotel for visitors to the World's Columbian Exposition. No Palmer House or Richelieu, certainly, but just comfortable enough and cheap enough to lure a certain kind of clientele, and convincing enough to justify a large fire insurance policy. After the fair, he intended to burn the building to collect the insurance, and, as a happy dividend, destroy whatever surplus material might remain in its hidden storage chambers, although ideally, given other disposal measures available to him, the building by then would contain nothing of an incriminating nature. The thing is, one never knew. In the most transcendent moments, it was easy to make mistakes and forget some little thing that a clever detective might eventually use to propel him to the gallows. Whether the Chicago police even possessed that kind of talent was open to question. The Pinkerton National Detective Agency was the more dangerous entity, but its operatives of late seemed to be spending most of their energy battling strikers at coal fields and steel mills and rail yards around the country. Again acting as his own architect, Holmes early in 1891 began planning the necessary modifications, and soon carpenters were at work on the second and third floors. Once again, Holmes's method of segregating tasks and firing workers was proving successful. Clearly, none of the workers had gone to the police. Patrolmen from the new Chicago Police Precinct House on Wentworth walked past Holmes's building each day. Far from being suspicious, the officers had become friendly, even protective. Holmes knew each by name. A cup of coffee, a free meal in his restaurant, a fine black cigar. Policemen valued these gestures of affinity and grace. Holmes was, however, beginning to feel mounting pressure from creditors, in particular from several furniture and bicycle dealers. He could still charm them and commiserate over their inability to locate the elusive deed holder, H.S. Campbell, But Holmes knew they soon would lose patience, and in fact was a bit surprised that they had not pursued him more forcefully than had been the case thus far. His techniques were too new, his skills too great, the men around him too naive, as if they had never before experienced a falsehood. For every business that now refused to sell him goods, there were a dozen more that fawned over him and accepted his notes endorsed by H.S. Campbell or secured by the assets of the Warner Glass Bending Company. When pressed, sensing that a particular creditor was on the verge of legal action, even violence, Holmes paid his bills in cash using money harvested from his own ventures, such as lease income from his apartments and stores, sales from his pharmacy, and the proceeds from his newest venture, a mail-order medicine company. In a parody of Aaron Montgomery Ward's fast-growing empire in central Chicago, Holmes had begun selling sham drugs that he guaranteed would cure alcoholism and baldness. He was always open to new financial opportunities, but especially now, since he knew that no matter how deftly he kept labor costs down, he still would have to pay for at least some of the transformation of his building. When Murta's great-uncle, Jonathan Belknap of Bigfoot Prairie, Illinois, came to Wilmette for a visit, that challenge suddenly seemed likely to resolve itself. Belknap was not a rich man, but he was well off. Holmes began appearing more frequently at the Wilmette house. He brought toys for Lucy, jewelry for Murta and her mother. He filled the house with love. Belknap had never met Holmes but knew all about his troubled marriage to Murta and was prepared to dislike the young doctor. On first meeting, he found Holmes far too smooth and self-assured for a man of so few years. He was struck, however, by how enthralled Murta seemed to be whenever Holmes was around, and how even Murta's mother, Belknap's niece by marriage, appeared to glow in Holmes's presence. After several more encounters, Belknap began to appreciate why Murta had fallen so thoroughly for the man. He was handsome and clean and dressed well, and spoke in fine sentences. His gaze was blue and forthright. In conversation, he listened with an intensity that was almost alarming, as if Belknap were the most fascinating man in the world, not just an elderly uncle visiting from Bigfoot Prairie. Belknap still did not like Holmes, but found his candor sufficiently disarming that when Holmes asked him to endorse a note for $2,500 to help cover the cost of a new house in Wilmette for himself and Murta, Belknap agreed. Holmes thanked him warmly. A new house, away from Murta's parents, might be all the couple needed to end their growing estrangement. Holmes promised to pay the money back as soon as his business affairs allowed. Holmes returned to Englewood and promptly forged Belknap's signature to a second note for the same amount, intending to use the proceeds for his hotel. On Holmes's next visit to Wilmette, he invited Belknap to visit Englewood for a tour of his building and of the newly chosen site for the World's Columbian Exposition. Although Belknap had read much about the World's Fair and did want to see its future home, he did not relish the idea of spending a full day with Holmes. Holmes was charming and gracious, but there was something about him that made Belknap uneasy. He could not have defined it. Indeed, for the next several decades, alienists and their successors would find themselves hard-pressed to describe with any precision what it was about men like Holmes that could cause them to seem so warm and ingratiating, but that could also telegraph the vague sense that some important element of humanness was missing. At first, alienists described this condition as moral insanity, and those who exhibited the disorder as moral imbeciles. They later adopted the term psychopath, first used in the lay press as early as 1885 in William Stead's Pall Mall Gazette, which described it as a new malady and stated, "Beside his own person and his own interests, nothing is sacred to the psychopath." Half a century later, in his path-breaking book, The Mask of Sanity, Dr. Hervey Cleckley described the prototypical psychopath as a subtly constructed reflex machine which can mimic the human personality perfectly. So perfect is his reproduction of a whole and normal man that no one who examines him in a clinical setting can point out in scientific or objective terms why or how he is not real. People exhibiting this purest form of the disorder would become known in the jargon of psychiatry as Cleckley psychopaths. When Belknap refused Holmes's offer, Holmes seemed to crumble with hurt and disappointment. The tour was necessary, Holmes pleaded, if only to bolster his own sense of honor and demonstrate to Belknap that he really was a man of means, and that Belknap's note was as secure an investment as any man could make. Murta, too, looked crestfallen. Belknap gave in. During the train journey to Englewood, Holmes pointed out landmarks. The skyscrapers of the city, the Chicago River, the stockyards. Belknap found the stench overpowering, but Holmes seemed not to notice it. The men exited the train at Englewood Station. The town was alive with movement. Trains rumbled past every few minutes. Horse-drawn streetcars moved east and west along 63rd, amid a dense traffic of carriages and drays. Everywhere Belknap looked, some building was under construction. Soon the level of construction would increase even more as entrepreneurs prepared to cash in on the expected crush of exposition visitors. Holmes described his own plans. He took Belknap on a tour of his pharmacy, with its marble countertops and glass containers filled with wildly colored solutions, then took him up to the second floor, where he introduced him to the building's caretaker, Patrick Quinlan. Holmes walked Belknap through the building's many corridors and described how the place would look as a hotel. Belknap found it bleak and strange, with passages that struck off in unexpected directions. Holmes asked Belknap if he would like to see the roof and the construction already underway. Belknap declined, claiming falsely that he was too old a man to climb that many steps. Holmes promised stirring views of Englewood, perhaps even a glimpse of Jackson Park off to the east, where the buildings of the fair soon would begin to rise. Again, Belknap resisted, this time with more force. Holmes tried a different approach. He invited Belknap to spend the night in his building. At first, Belknap declined this offer as well, but feeling perhaps that he had been overly rude in avoiding the roof, he relented. After nightfall, Holmes led Belknap to a room on the second floor. Gas lamps had been installed at haphazard intervals along the corridor, leaving pockets of gloom whose borders shivered as Belknap and Holmes moved past. The room was furnished and comfortable enough, and overlooked the street, which was still reassuringly busy. As far as Belknap could tell, he and Holmes were by now the only occupants of the building. "When I went to bed," Belknap said, "I carefully locked the door." Soon the street sounds receded, leaving only the rumble of trains and the hollow clip-clop of an occasional horse. Belknap had difficulty sleeping. He stared at the ceiling, which was bathed in the shifting light of the street lamps below his window. Hours passed. "Presently," Belknap said, "I heard my door tried, and then a key was slipped into the lock." Belknap called out, asking who was at the door. The noise stopped. He held his breath and listened, and heard the sound of feet moving down the hall. He was certain that initially two men had been outside his door, but now one of them had left. He called again. This time a voice answered. Belknap recognized it as belonging to Patrick Quinlan, the caretaker. Quinlan wanted to come in. "I refused to open the door," Belknap said. He insisted for a time and then went away. Belknap lay awake the rest of the night. Soon afterward, he discovered Holmes's forgery. Holmes apologized, claiming a dire need for money, and was so persuasive and abject that even Belknap felt mollified, although his distrust of Holmes persisted. Much later, Belknap realized why Holmes had wanted so badly to show him the building's roof. "If I'd gone," Belknap said, "the forgery probably wouldn't have been discovered, because I wouldn't have been around to discover it." "But I didn't go," he said. "I'm afraid of heights." As carpenters and plasterers worked on his building, Holmes turned his attention to the creation of an important accessory. He sketched a number of possible designs, relying perhaps on past observations of similar equipment, then settled on a configuration that seemed likely to work. A large rectangular box of fireproof brick about 8 feet deep, 3 feet high, and 3 feet wide, encased within a second box of the same material, with the space between them heated by flames from an oil burner. The inner box would serve as an elongated kiln. Although he had never built a kiln before, he believed his design would generate temperatures extreme enough to incinerate anything within. That the kiln also be able to destroy any odors emanating from the interior box was singularly important. He planned to install the kiln in the basement and hired a bricklayer named Joseph E. Berkler to do the job. He told him he intended to use the kiln to produce and bend plate glass for his Warner Glass Bending Company. At Holmes's instructions, Berkler added a number of components made of iron. He worked quickly, and soon the kiln was ready for its first test. Holmes ignited the burner. There was a satisfying whoosh. A wave of warmth rolled from the chamber to the far walls of the basement. The scent of partially combusted oil suffused the air. But the test was disappointing. The box did not generate as much heat as he had hoped. He adjusted the burner and tried again, but achieved little improvement. He used the city directory to locate a furnace company and requested an appointment with an experienced man. He identified himself as the founder of Warner Glass. If, for some reason, officials of the furnace company felt moved to verify that Warner Glass existed, all they had to do was check the 1890 Englewood directory to find the company's listing, with Holmes named as proprietor. The manager of the furnace company, his name was never made public, decided to attend the matter personally and met Holmes at his building. He found a young, good-looking man, almost delicate, who conveyed an air of confidence and prosperity. He had striking blue eyes. His building was on the gloomy side, the construction obviously below the standards of structures rising elsewhere on 63rd, but it was well located in a community that clearly was booming. For so young a man to own most of a city block was itself an accomplishment. The manager followed Holmes to his second-floor office, and there, in the pleasant cross breeze from the corner windows, studied Holmes's drawings of his kiln. Holmes explained that he could not obtain the necessary amount of heat. The manager asked to see the apparatus. "That wasn't necessary," Holmes said. He did not wish to trouble the manager, only to seek his advice, for which, of course, he would pay an appropriate fee. The furnace man insisted he could do nothing without actually examining the kiln. Holmes smiled. Of course. If the manager did not mind spending the extra time, he would be glad to show it to him. Holmes led his visitor down two to the first floor, and from there down another, darker flight to the basement. They entered a large rectangular cavern that ran the entire length of the block, interrupted only by beams and posts. In the shadows stood vats and barrels and mounds of dark matter, possibly soil. A long, narrow table with a steel top stood under a series of unlit lamps, and two worn leather cases rested nearby. The cellar had the look of a mine, the smell of a surgeon's suite. The furnace man examined the kiln. He saw that it contained an inner chamber of fire brick constructed in a manner that kept flames from reaching the interior, and noted the clever addition of two openings in the top of the inner box that would allow the flow of gases from the box into the surrounding flames, where these gases would then be consumed. It was an interesting design and seemed likely to work, although he did observe to himself that the shape of the kiln seemed unsuited to the task of bending glass. The inner box was too small to admit the broad panes now appearing in storefronts throughout the city. Otherwise, he noticed nothing unusual and foresaw no difficulty improving the kiln's operation. He returned with a work crew. The men installed a more powerful burner, which, once ignited, heated the kiln to 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Holmes seemed pleased. Only later did the furnace man recognize that the kiln's peculiar shape and extreme heat made it ideal for another, very different application. In fact, he said, the general plan of the furnace was not unlike that of a crematory for dead bodies, and with the provision already described, there would be absolutely no odor from the furnace. But again, that was later. Holmes's absences from Wilmeet lengthened once again, although at regular intervals he sent Murda and his daughter enough money to keep them comfortable. He even insured the girl's life, since children, after all, were such fragile things and could be taken from the world in a heartbeat. His businesses were doing well. His mail-order company brought in a surprising amount of cash, and he began trying to find a way to capitalize on the latest medical rage, a cure for alcoholism invented by a physician named Keeley in Dwight, Illinois. The corner drugstore ran smoothly and profitably, although one woman in the neighborhood observed that he seemed to have difficulty retaining the young and typically attractive women he often hired as clerks. These clerks, as far as she could tell, had an unfortunate habit of departing without warning, sometimes even leaving their personal belongings in their rooms on the second floor. She saw such behavior as a troubling sign of the rising shiftlessness of the age. The work of turning Holmes's building into a hotel proceeded slowly, with the usual bouts of rancor and delay. Holmes left the task of finding replacement workers to his three helpers, Quinlan, Chapel, and Pititzel. They seemed to have little difficulty finding new men for each new opening. Thousands of workers laid off elsewhere had come to Chicago hoping for jobs building the fair, only to find that too many workers had gotten the same idea, thus leaving a large pool of men available for work. Any work, at any price. Holmes turned his attention to other, more pleasant distractions. Sheer fate had brought two new women into his life, one of them nearly 6 feet tall and possessed of a rapturous body. The other, her sister-in-law, a lovely young woman with black hair and exquisite dark eyes. That the tall one came equipped with a husband and daughter only enhanced her appeal. It made the situation infinitely more appealing. The landscape of regret. The Eastern Architects left New Jersey at 4:50 p.m., January 8, 1891, in Car 5, Section 6 of the North Shore Limited, which Hunt had reserved so that all the architects could travel together. Olmsted had come down from Boston the night before in order to join them. It was a bewitching moment. A gorgeous train rocketing through the winter landscape carrying five of history's greatest architects, all in the same car, gossiping, joking, drinking, smoking. Olmsted used the opportunity to describe in detail Jackson Park and the trials of dealing with the exposition's many layers of committees that for the moment seemed to have so much power. He respected Burnham for his candor, directness, and the air of leadership he exuded, and no doubt told the architects as much. That he spent a good deal of time asserting his own vision of the exposition's landscape is also beyond doubt, especially his belief that the wooded island should remain entirely free of conspicuous man-made structures. 2 hours before the train reached Chicago, during a brief stop, McKim received a cable notifying him that his mother, Sarah McKim, had died unexpectedly in her home at 78. The two had been very close. He left the group and caught a return train. The architects arrived in Chicago late Friday night and took carriages to the Wellington Hotel, where Burnham had arranged rooms for all. Van Brunt, arriving from Kansas City, joined them there. The next morning they boarded carriages for the journey south to Jackson Park. Root, absent, was to return that day from Atlanta. The ride to the park took about an hour. It was one of those cold winter days, Burnham recalled. The sky was overcast with clouds and the lake covered with foam. At the park, the architects eased from the carriages, puffing blasts of steam into the frigid air. The wind picked up motes of sand which stung their cheeks and forced them to shield their eyes. They stumbled over the frozen ground, Hunt wincing from gout, cursing, disbelieving. Olmsted, his teeth inflamed, his night an ordeal of wakefulness, limping from his long-ago carriage accident. The lake was gray, darkening to a band of black at the horizon. The only color in the vicinity was the frost rouge on the men's cheeks and the blue of Burnham's and Olmsted's eyes. Olmsted watched for the architect's reactions. Now and then he and Burnham caught each other's glances. The architects were stunned. They gazed, Burnham said, with a feeling almost of despair. Jackson Park was 1 square mile of desolation, mostly treeless, save for pockets of various kinds of oak, bur, pin, black, and scarlet, rising from a tangled undergrowth of elder, wild plum, and willow. In the most exposed portions there was only sand, tufted with marine and prairie grasses. One writer called the park remote and repulsive. Another, a sandy waste of unredeemed and desert land. It was ugly, a landscape of last resort. Olmsted himself had said of Jackson Park, "If a search had been made for the least park-like ground within miles of the city, nothing better meeting the requirement could have been found." In fact, the site was even worse than it appeared to the eye. Many of the oaks were dead. Given the season, the dead were hard to distinguish from the living. The root systems of others were badly damaged. Test borings showed the earth within the park consisted of a top layer of black soil about 1 foot thick, followed by 2 feet of sand, then 11 feet of sand, so saturated with water, Burnham wrote, it became almost like quicksand and was often given this name. The Chicago men understood the challenge this soil presented. The New York men, accustomed to bedrock, did not. The park's gravest flaw, at least from Olmsted's perspective, was that its shoreline was subject to dramatic annual changes in the level of the lake, perhaps as much as 4 feet. Such fluctuations, Olmsted recognized, would greatly increase the difficulty of planting the banks and shores. If the water level fell, visitors to the fair would be treated to an offensive band of bare earth at the waterline. If it rose too high, the water would submerge and kill shore plantings. The architects climbed back into their carriages. They drove toward the lake over the park's rough roads at the pace of a funeral cortege, and with equal gloom. Burnham wrote, "A feeling of discouragement allied to hopelessness came over those who then first realized the extent and magnitude of the proposed undertaking, and appreciated the inexorable conditions of a time limitation to the work. 21 months later was the day fixed by Act of Congress for the dedication of the buildings, and in the short space of 27 1/2 months, or on May 1, 1893, the entire work of construction must be finished, the landscape perfected, and the exhibits installed." At the lake, they again left their carriages. Peabody of Boston climbed atop a pier. He turned to Burnham. "Do you mean to say that you really propose opening a fair here by 93? "Yes," Burnham said. "We intend to." Peabody said, "It can't be done." Burnham looked at him. "That point is settled," he said. But even he did not and could not grasp what truly lay ahead. Root returned to Chicago while the architects were in Jackson Park. It was his 41st birthday. He went directly from the train station to the rookery. He went down to the office in a gay humor, Harriet Monroe said, and that very day received a commission for a large commercial building. But that afternoon, draftsman Paul Sterrett encountered Root in one of the rookery's elevators, looking ill. His good spirits had fled. He complained again of being tired. The architects returned from their tour discouraged and full of regret. They gathered again in the firm's library, where Root, suddenly revitalized, now joined them. He was gracious, funny, warm. If anyone could sway these men and ignite their passion, Burnham knew, Root was the one. Root invited the outside men to come to his house on Astor Place the next day, Sunday, for high tea, then went home, at last, to greet his children and his wife, Dora, who, according to Harriet Monroe, was in bed, ill almost unto death, from a recent miscarriage. Root told Dora of his weariness and suggested that in the coming summer they should escape somewhere for a long rest. The last months had been full of frustration and long nights of work and travel. He was exhausted. The trip south had done nothing to ease his stress. He looked forward to the end of the week, to January 15th, when the architects would conclude their conference and go home. After the 15th, he told his wife, I shall not be so busy. The Eastern and Chicago architects reconvened that night at the University Club for a dinner in their honor, hosted by the Fair's Grounds and Buildings Committee. Root was too tired to attend. Clearly the dinner was a weapon meant to ignite enthusiasm and show the Easterners that Chicago fully intended to follow through on its grand boasts about the exposition. It was the first in a sequence of impossibly rich and voluminous banquets whose menus raised the question of whether any of the city's leading men could possibly have a functional artery. As the men arrived, reporters intercepted them. The architects were gracious, but close-mouthed. They sat at a large T-shaped table with Lyman Gage, president of the exposition, at the center of the topmost table, Hunt on his right, Olmsted on his left. Bundles of carnations and pink and red roses transformed the tables into cutting beds. A boutonniere rested beside each plate. Everyone wore tuxedos. There was not a woman in sight. At precisely 8 p.m., Gage took Hunt and Olmsted by the arm and led the way from the club's reception room to the banquet hall. Oysters. A glass or two of Montrachet. Consommé of green turtle. Amontillado. Broiled shad à la maréchale. Cucumbers. Potatoes à la duchesse. Filet mignon à la Rossini. Château Lafitte and Renard Brut. Fonds d'entrechaux farci. Pommery sec. Sorbet au kirsch. Cigarettes. Woodcock on toast. Asparagus sala. Ices. Canton ginger. Cheeses. Pont-l'Evêque. Roquefort. Coffee. Liqueurs. Madeira. 1815. Cigars. Gage spoke first. He offered a rousing oration on the brilliance of the future exposition and the need now for the great men in the banquet hall to think first of the fair, last of themselves. That only through the subordination of self would the exposition succeed. The applause was warm and enthusiastic. Burnham spoke next. He described his own vision of the fair and Chicago's resolve to make that vision real. He, too, urged teamwork and self-sacrifice. Gentlemen, he said, 1893 will be the third great date in our country's history. On the two others, 1776 and 1861, all true Americans served. And so now I ask you to serve again. This time, the room erupted. The men left the banquet hall that night united like soldiers in a campaign, Burnham said. It was the Chicagoans, however, who did all the marching. At Root's house the next day, Harriet Monroe met the Eastern architects and came away shaken. In talking with them, I was amazed at their listless and hopeless attitude, she said. Beautiful effects were scarcely to be expected in buildings so enormous and so cheaply constructed. The level of monotony of ground surfaces in Chicago made effective grouping practically impossible. The time for preparation and construction was too short. These and other criticisms indicated a general feeling of disparagement. At Tea's End, Root escorted the visitors to their carriages. It was dark and bitterly cold. A sharp wind scythed along Astor Place. Much was made in retrospect of the fact that Root, in evening dress, charged into the rock-cold night without first putting on a coat. Vanishing Point. After years spent drifting from town to town and job to job, a young jeweler named Icilius Connor, he preferred the nickname Ned, moved to Chicago with his wife Julia and their 8-year-old daughter Pearl, and quickly found that Chicago was indeed a city of opportunity. At the start of 1891, Ned found himself managing a jewelry counter that occupied one wall of a thriving drugstore on the city's south side, at 63rd and Wallace. For once in Ned's adult life, the future gleamed. The owner of the drugstore, though very young, was prosperous and dynamic, truly a man of the age, and seemed destined for even greater success, given that the World's Columbian Exposition was to be built just a short streetcar ride east at the end of 63rd. There was talk, too, that a newly elevated rail line, nicknamed the Alley L for the way its trestles roofed city alleys, would be extended eastward along 63rd directly to Jackson Park, thus providing visitors with another means of reaching the future fair. Already traffic on the street had increased sharply, as each day hundreds of citizens drove their carriages to the park to see the chosen site. Not that there was much to see. Ned and Julia had found the park an ugly, desolate place of sandy ridges and half-dead oaks, although Pearl had enjoyed trying to catch tadpoles in its pools of stagnant water. That anything wonderful could rise on that ground seemed beyond possibility, although Ned, like most new visitors to Chicago, was willing to concede that the city was a place unlike any he had encountered. If any city could make good on the elaborate boasts circulated thus far, Chicago was the one. Ned's new employer, Dr. H. H. Holmes, seemed a perfect example of what everyone called the Chicago spirit. To be so young, yet own a restaurant, barbershop, and drugstore, and the block-long building that housed them, would be incredible in any other place of Ned's experience. Here, it seemed an ordinary accomplishment. The Connors lived in a flat on the second floor of the building, near Dr. Holmes's own suite of rooms. It was not the brightest, most cheerful apartment, but it was warm and close to work, and the building's location allowed Pearl to attend the famous Cook County Normal School a few blocks away. Moreover, Holmes offered to employ Julia as a clerk in the drugstore and to train her to keep his books. And later, when Ned's 18-year-old sister Gertrude moved to Chicago, Holmes asked to hire her as well, to manage his new mail-order medicine company. With three incomes, the family might soon be able to afford a house of their own, perhaps on one of the wide macadam streets of Englewood. Certainly they'd be able to afford bicycles and trips to Timmerman's Theater down the street. One thing did make Ned uneasy, however. Holmes seemed inordinately attentive to Gertie and Julia. On one level, this was natural and something to which Ned had become accustomed, for both women were great beauties. Gertie slim and dark, Julia tall and felicitously proportioned. It was clear to Ned, clear in fact from the first moment, that Holmes was a man who liked women, and whom women liked in return. Lovely young women seemed drawn to the drugstore. When Ned tried to help them, they were remote and uninterested. Their manner changed markedly if Holmes happened then to enter the store. Always a plain man, Ned now seemed to become part of the background, a bystander to his own life. Only his daughter Pearl was as attentive to him as always. Ned watched with alarm as Holmes flattered Gertie and Julia with smiles and gifts and treacly praise, especially Gertie, and how the women glowed in response. When Holmes left them, they appeared crestfallen, their demeanor suddenly brittle and snappish. Even more disconcerting was the change in how customers responded to Ned himself. It was not what they said, rather what they carried in their eyes. Something like sympathy, even pity. One night during this period, Holmes asked Ned a favor. He led him to the big vault and stepped inside, then told Ned to close the door and listen for the sound of his shouting. "I shut the door and put my ear to the crack," Ned recalled, "but could hear only a faint sound." Ned opened the door and Holmes stepped out. Now Holmes asked Ned if he would go inside and try shouting so that Holmes could hear for himself how little sound escaped. Ned did so, but got back out the instant Holmes reopened the door. "I didn't like that kind of business," he said. Why anyone would even want a soundproof vault was a question that apparently did not occur to him. For the police, there were warnings of a different sort. Letters from parents, visits from detectives hired by parents, but these were lost in the chaos. Vanishment seemed a Chicago pastime. There were too many disappearances in all parts of the city to investigate properly, and too many forces tending to impede the detection of patterns. Patrolmen, many of them, were barely competent, appointed solely at the direction of ward bosses. Detectives were few, their resources and skills minimal. Class obscured their vision. Ordinary vanishings. Polish girls, stockyard boys, Italian laborers, Negro women merited little effort. Only the disappearance of moneyed souls drew a forceful response, and even then there was little detectives could do other than send telegrams to other cities and periodically check the morgue for each day's collection of unidentified men, women, and children. At one point, half the city's detective force was involved in investigating disappearances, prompting the chief of the city's central detective unit to announce he was considering the formation of a separate bureau, a mysterious disappearances department. Women and men vanished in equal proportion. Fanny Moore, a young visitor from Memphis, failed to return to the home where she was boarding and was never seen again. J.W. Heiliman left work one day, caught a suburban train, and vanished, the Tribune said, as completely as though swallowed by the earth. The women were presumed to have been ravished, the men robbed, their corpses plunged into the turgid waters of the Chicago River or the alleys of Halstead and the Levee and that hard stretch of Clark between Polk and Taylor, known to veteran officers as Cheyenne. Found bodies went to the morgue. If unclaimed, they traveled next to the dissection amphitheater at Rush Medical College or perhaps Cook County Hospital, and from there to the articulation laboratory for the delicate task of picking flesh and connective tissue from the bones and skull, washing all with bleach, and remounting same for the subsequent use of doctors, anatomy museums, and the occasional private collector of scientific novelties. The hair was sold for wigs, the clothing given to settlement houses. As was the case at the Union Stockyards, Chicago wasted nothing. Alone. The Eastern and Chicago architects met again on Monday morning, January 12th, in Burnham and Root's library on the top floor of the Rookery. Root was absent. William R. Meade had come from New York to stand in for his grieving partner, McKim. As the men waited for everyone to arrive, the visitors from time to time would drift to the library's east-facing windows and stare out at the vastness of Lake Michigan. The light entering the room was preternaturally intense, carrying with it the surplus radiance of the lake and its frozen shore. Burnham rose to offer the men a formal welcome, but he did not seem at ease. He was aware of the lingering reticence of the Eastern men and seemed hell-bent on winning them with flattery that verged on unction, a tactic that Lewis Sullivan had known Burnham to deploy with great effect. Himself not especially susceptible to flattery, except in a sentimental way, he soon learned its efficacy when plastered thick on big businessmen, Sullivan wrote. Lewis saw it done repeatedly and at first was amazed at Burnham's effrontery, only to be more amazingly amazed at the drooling of the recipient. The method was crude, but it worked. Said Sullivan, "It soon became noticeable that he was progressively and grossly apologizing to the Eastern men for the presence of their benighted brethren of the West." Hunt noticed it too. "Hell," he snapped, "we haven't come here on a missionary expedition. Let's get to work." Murmurs of agreement rose through the room. Adler was cheered. Sullivan smirked. Olmsted watched, deadpan, as he listened to a roaring in his ears that would not subside. Hunt grimaced. The trip from New York and the excursion to Jackson Park had worsened his gout. Hunt's interjection startled Burnham. It brought back in a rush the hurt of the great dual snub by the East, his rejection by Harvard and Yale. But the remark and the obvious support it garnered in the room also caused Burnham to shift focus to the work at hand. As Sullivan saw it, Burnham came out of his somnambulistic vagary and joined in. He was keen enough to understand that Uncle Dick, meaning Hunt, had done him a needed favor. Burnham told the men that henceforth they would serve as the fair's board of architects. He invited them to choose a chairman. They elected Hunt. "The natural dominance of the master again asserted itself without pretension," wrote Van Brunt, "and we once again became his willing and happy pupils." For secretary they elected Sullivan, who most decidedly was not a happy pupil of Hunt's. To him, Hunt was the janissary of a dead vernacular. Burnham, too. Both men symbolized all that stood in the way of his own emerging ethos, that a building's function should express itself in its design, not merely that form should follow function, but that the function created or organized its form. To Sullivan, Hunt was merely a relic, Burnham something far more dangerous. In him, Sullivan saw a kindred capacity for obsession. Sullivan had come to see Chicago architecture as dominated by only two firms, Burnham and Root and Adler and Sullivan. In each firm was a man with a fixed, irrevocable purpose in life, for the sake of which he would bend or sacrifice all else, Sullivan wrote. Daniel Burnham was obsessed by the feudal idea of power. Lewis Sullivan was equally obsessed by the beneficent idea of democratic power. Sullivan admired both Root and Adler, but believed they functioned on a lesser plane. John Root was so self-indulgent that there was a risk he might never draw upon his underlying power. Adler was essentially a technician, an engineer, a conscientious administrator. Unquestionably, Adler lacked sufficient imagination. So, in a way, did John Root. That is to say, the imagination of the dreamer. In the dream imagination lay Burnham's strength and Lewis's passion. Shortly before noon, Burnham left the room to take a telephone call from Dora Root. She told him her husband had awakened with a bad cold and would not be able to attend the meeting. Several hours later, she called again. A doctor had come and diagnosed pneumonia. Root's spirits were good. He joked and sketched. "I haven't escaped sickness all my life to get off easily now," he told Harriet Monroe. "I knew when my turn came, it would be a tartar." The architects continued to meet, but without Burnham, who stayed beside his partner's bed except for occasional departures to help resolve issues back in the library, or to visit Hunt, whose gout had grown so painful he was confined to his room in the Wellington Hotel. Root joked with his nurses. At its regular Wednesday meeting, the Grounds and Buildings Committee passed a resolution wishing Root a speedy recovery. That day, Burnham wrote to a Chicago architect named W. W. Boyington. Mr. Root is quite low and there is uncertainty about his recovery, but still a chance for him. On Thursday, Root seemed to rally. Burnham again wrote to Boynton, "Am able this morning to give you a little better report. He has passed a pretty good night and is easier. While the danger is not over, we are hopeful." Enthusiasm among the architects rose. With Hunt still confined to his room, Post stood in as chairman. He and Van Brunt shuttled to and from Hunt's hotel. The architects approved the original brown paper plan fashioned by Burnham, Olmsted, and Root with few changes. They decided how big the main buildings should be and how they should be situated on the site. They chose a uniform style, neoclassical, meaning buildings would have columns and pediments and evoke the glories of ancient Rome. This was anathema to Sullivan, who abhorred derivative architecture, but during the meeting he made no objection. The architects also made what would prove to be one of the most important decisions of the fair, to set a uniform height, 60 feet, for the cornice of each of the palaces of the Court of Honor. A cornice was merely a horizontal decorative projection. Walls, roofs, domes, and arches could rise far higher, but by establishing this one point of commonality, the architects ensured a fundamental harmony among the fair's most imposing structures. At about 4 o'clock Thursday afternoon, Codman and Burnham drove to Root's house. Codman waited in the carriage as Burnham went inside. Burnham found Root struggling for breath. Throughout the day, Root had experienced strange dreams, including one that had come to him many times in the past of flying through the air. When Root saw Burnham, he said, "You won't leave me again, will you?" Burnham said no, but he did leave, to check on Root's wife, who was in a neighboring room. As Burnham talked with her, a relative also entered the room. She told them Root was dead. In his last moments, she said, he had run his fingers over his bedding as if playing the piano. "Do you hear that?" he whispered. "Isn't it wonderful? That's what I call music." The house settled into an eerie post-mortem quiet broken only by the hiss of gas lamps and the weary tick of clocks. Burnham paced the floor below. He did not know it, but he was being watched. Harriet Monroe's Aunt Nettie sat on a step high on the dark upper curve of the stairway that rose from Root's living room to the second floor. The woman listened as Burnham paced. A fire burned in the hearth behind him and cast large shadows on the opposing wall. "I have worked," Burnham said. "I have schemed and dreamed to make us the greatest architects in the world. I have made him see it and kept him at it. And now he dies. Damn, damn, damn." Root's death stunned Burnham, stunned Chicago. Burnham and Root had been partners and friends for 18 years. Each knew the other's thoughts. Each had come to rely on the other for his skills. Now, Root was gone. Outsiders wondered if Root's death might mean the death of the exposition. The newspapers were full of interviews in which the city's leading men described Root as the guiding force behind the fair, that without him the city could not hope to realize its dreams. The Tribune said Root was, easily, Chicago's most distinguished architect, if indeed he had his superior in the whole country. Edward Jeffrey, chairman of the Grounds and Buildings Committee, said, "There is no man in the profession of architects who has the genius and ability to take up the exposition work